I want to start pretty near the end tonight. I think it might be helpful for those of you who spent the afternoon on Camber Sands. Hot sun, fresh sea air. You may not be still with us when we get to the end tonight. So you'll at least have had a fighting chance. I want to start pretty near the end tonight in the hope that you might then want to listen to the beginning. Put it this way, I'm trying to put myself in the shoes of the impatient man or woman whose mind is already racing to that bit that, you know, some people, it's the only bit of the sermon they ever come for, the kind of application, which is why if it's always in the last 5 minutes, you know, why waste your breath for the first 20? And they're sort of saying, look, the story of the Red Sea is all very well, but what's it got to do with me? Especially what's it got to do with me when we get out of this cosy world and back into what seems a very different world outside of here? What am I meant to make of it? Is it some kind of bargaining counter? You know, you've got Israel out of Egypt, now get me out of this hole. Is really the whole point of this story of the wipeout of the Egyptians and the rescue of the Israelites, just be faithful in a tight fix? Or more likely, is it some kind of pep talk for difficult times? You know, God will win the battles for us. Is the lesson of this meant to mean that my any kind of bad hair day I have, I look at as my personal Egypt? Any person that we dislike or gives us grief becomes our personal Pharaoh. And then we pray for the Red Sea experience. Well, no. In case you thought otherwise. No, because that's not the way the Bible uses the Exodus. That is the way that leads to great disappointment in God when our expected deliverance does not appear in the way we imagine it'll appear. But the New Testament does not involve Exodus, for example, when dealing with intense personal suffering. Listen to James. Consider it pure joy, my brothers, whenever you face trials of many kinds, because you know that the testing of your faith develops perseverance. Perseverance must finish its work so that you may be mature and complete, not lacking anything. Or listen to Peter, who again doesn't invoke Exodus when he writes this. Dear friends, don't be surprised at the painful trial you're suffering, as though something strange were happening to you, but rejoice that you participate in the sufferings of Christ so that you may be overjoyed when his glory is revealed. There's not a hint of God will deliver you as he did Israel from Egypt. It's patiently endure. Not you'll get out of it. Now, this is not a story about a bargaining counter. Much more a story about an identity card. For the Exodus is the foundational event in Israel's history. And again, the Bible looks to this as the making of them as a people. And who are these people? Well, no one special. The Lord didn't set his affection on you and choose you because you were more numerous than other people, but for you were the fewest of all peoples. But it was because the Lord loved you and kept the oath he swore to your forefathers, that he brought you out with a mighty hand and redeemed you from the land of slavery, from the power of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. That's how Deuteronomy 7, 7 and 8 puts it. Why did God love these people? Because he loved these people. But notice, you see, as the Bible handles the Exodus, it's not a picture of what God will do for us, but of what God has already done for us. God's calling people out of one type of existence and into another. This is his rescue, his salvation. And it's God who battles for us. It's God who breaks the grips of the forces of evil. and chaos that want to go on enslaving us. And the New Testament takes this great escape and compares it with baptism. Here's how Paul writes to the Corinthians in 1 Corinthians 10. I don't want you to be ignorant of the fact, brothers, that our forefathers were all under the cloud and that they all passed through the sea and they were all baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. Now, baptism is what gives me my Christian identity. Baptism tells me I pass from one type of existence into another, from death to life. Baptism, like the Exodus, is a reminder not that God will win battles for me, but that God has won the battle for me. If I'm a Christian, my Egypt is behind me. If I'm Christian, I'm on the other side of the sea. If I want to know how I'm expected to behave there, well, then the most important part of the book is still to come, and we'll touch on it in the next couple of evenings. But if I want to head out of here confident of where I stand, well, then this story of the crossing of the Red Sea is a reminder of my identity. Want to know what gives someone the identity of Christian? It's the Red Sea experience. So come with me to Exodus 14. Allow me to limber up a little longer before we come into it. But it is a very significant picture in the Bible story. One of the things that has been fascinating, to put it mildly, in the whole course of the lead up to the war itself and the aftermath of the Iraqi war has been the tension between politicians and the media and during it even the military and the media. If you remember back to the war, there was that wonderful Iraqi press officer who came out with the tremendous statements about how the coalition, that was a wonderful phrase, wasn't it, coalition forces, how both countries' forces were defeated and got nowhere and in the desert, and that night Baghdad airport fell. But there was also plenty of suspicion up the side with the American High Command and the British High Command as to what their briefings were saying. I remember hearing one radio reporter at Central Command in Qatar was asked to update us on how things were going, and his report came over something like this. It's hard to piece together just what's going on. The military here are very focused on getting the job done and very slow to give us who are paying for this war the information about what is going on. Extraordinarily arrogant attitude, wasn't it? I reckon if I was a soldier, that's precisely the kind of attitude I would want my press officer to be having, giving precious little information away about just what's going on. Well, you come to Exodus 14 and you'll read here the kind of battle plan briefing that the media never managed to get their hands on during the Iraqi war. Verse 1, the Lord said to Moses, tell the Israelites to turn back and camp near Pihahiroth, between all these funny places and the sea. Basically, he's saying, let's do it the hard way. Have the men, the women and the children, walk into a dead end. Then you see verse 4, I'll harden Pharaoh's hearts and he will pursue them. Then I'll get Pharaoh to change his mind yet again and come rushing in behind them. And as a result, I will give glory to myself through Pharaoh and all his army, and the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord. You remember we saw yesterday the whole clash around the plagues was about the identity of who was this God. Well, if they hadn't learnt the lesson already, and they're not going to have learnt the lesson already, they're going to discover it this day. For only God, the God, could get the Israelites out of this. The whole point of doing it the hard way is to show that it is the Lord at work. If you flick on to verse 25 of chapter 14, you discover right at the end there, the Egyptians get the message. For they say, the Lord is fighting for them against Egypt. And when you get to chapter 15 and verse 11, well, you discover that everyone else should get the message as well. Who among the gods is like you, O Lord? Moses is given every confidence in God, the God who is able to rescue them from the deepest hole, the God who will not be caught out by any enemy surprises. See, as we come back to the beginning of chapter 14, I will harden Pharaoh's heart, he says. Now, we saw yesterday that's not meaning that Pharaoh is not responsible for his own actions. It's just a reminder to us that that there is no change of plan, no fresh tactics that Pharaoh can conjure up which will allow him to escape God's sovereignty. He may resist God's plans, but he'll still find himself part of them. There's no power sharing here. No sort of dualism, as if we've got the Lord on the one hand and some other equal and opposite force, be it Egyptian Pharaoh or Egyptian God, as if these two are on any kind of equal footing. And here is the confidence for our hope. There is no enslaving power too strong for God to break. The Egyptians will know that I am the Lord. Now, of course, Egyptian minds were full of no such thoughts. You come to verse 5. When the king of Egypt was told that the people had fled, Pharaoh and his officials changed their minds about them and said, "What have we done? We let the Israelites go and have lost their services." It's got all the feeling of the morning after the night before, hasn't it? Wake up, discover what's gone. What have we done? No country can afford to lose its workforce overnight. You can imagine, can't you? I mean, Gordon Brown's hammering on Pharaoh's door straight away. I've got a budget to keep. The economy's ruined. So, verse 6, Pharaoh had his chariots made ready and took his army with him. And we're off to the battle. Now, I just want to focus on two or three things this evening as we run through this incident. And the first is, I think, something significant up the Egyptian end, what I've called the chariots of terror. The chariots of terror. And they're there from verse 5 to 20 of chapter 14. As Pharaoh saddles his chariots, or whatever you do to them, and charges out after the Israelites, you eventually get to verse 10. As Pharaoh approached, the Israelites looked up, and there were the Egyptians marching after them. Put yourself in the Israelite shoes for a moment. You've got sea in front, you've got desert hills to the sides, and behind them, Egyptians. And their chariots. Every great army tends to have a weapon that strikes fear and terror into the hearts of its enemies. The Egyptian equivalent of Tomahawk or cruise missiles, B-52 bombers, were those chariots. And they're actually mentioned 9 times in the chapter. I take it they're Pharaoh's pride and joy, just because they were all his enemies' fear and dread. And as verse 10 goes on, the Israelites see the Egyptians marching behind them, and they were terrified and cried out to the Lord. The Israelites are poorly equipped, they're not well trained, they're amateur freedom fighters up against crack troops, and they were terrified. Don't know what they cried out to the Lord, do know what they said to Moses, their God-given deliverer. They grumbled, verse 11. Was it because there were no graves in Egypt that you brought us to the desert to die? What have you done to us by bringing us out of Egypt? Didn't we say to you in Egypt, leave us alone, let us serve the Egyptians? You know, at first sight, that kind of line sounds sort of ludicrous, doesn't it? At second sight, you just realise how true to life the Bible keeps on being. I mean, in crises, memories are incredibly short, aren't they? When terrified, it's hard to think beyond the very short term. These are the Israelites who have just experienced God's power to remarkable effect through the plagues, and especially through the Passover night. Yet I doubt any of us are very different. We can have a lifetime of seeing God to work at work, can't we? And faced with a new situation, still find panic setting in. As I wonder, can God possibly cope with this? Has he abandoned me? Ever stood in those shoes? It can really be quite frightening to some of us that we can have actually been 20, 30, 40 years following Christ and know the panic moment. As if all that he's done in keeping us and delivering us over those 20, 30, 40 years stands for nothing when I'm in this new situation. And what about Moses? Well, he looks to be keeping his cool, doesn't he? Moses answered the people, verse 13, who would much rather have served the Egyptians, they say, than die in the desert. And Moses answered the people, he's got no intention of planning a neat graveyard out in the desert. Don't be afraid. Stand firm and you'll see the deliverance the Lord will bring you today. The Egyptians you see today, you will never see again. The Lord will fight for you. You need only to be still. They're fine, strong words. There's none of this sort of, there, calm down, God will take care of you stuff. It's far tougher than that. You need only be still is rather a weak translation. It's much closer to shut up. Stop whining. Only verse 15 is at first sight hard to put together, isn't it? The Lord said to Moses, why are you crying out to me? Is this really the Lord responding to the Israelites through their leader, or is the Lord actually seeing Moses' heart? Because he's speaking you singular. I confess, I wonder if this isn't just the loneliness of leadership. Underneath the brave, confident words, is there a heart full of its own terror? The leader who knows what he must say, sticks his head above the parapet, tells the truth as it should be told, and then, well, if you've ever led, you know the and then moment, don't you? There's nothing wrong with what you said, nothing wrong with the decision made, nothing wrong with the lead given. It's just that awful moment between the speaking of it and anything actually coming about. And who's the one with the real egg on the face if it never gets further than words? Now, there's something very wearing about leadership for just that kind of reason. We're trying to launch a church plant in Sheffield this autumn. It's taken us 2.5 years trying to negotiate with all kinds of different people to do some gospel ministry outside of our parish in an area where they're building houses that are going to be 7,000 new people moving in this year alone. Everyone has told us that none of the churches around are equipped and in a position to reach them with the gospel. And yet, time and again, we keep finding obstacles and difficulties. And for two or three of us in particular, we've been the ones that have had to take the lead. And then you say, well, we'll go and do it. And you wonder, well, actually, will anyone actually want to go on the church plants? That awful moment, isn't it? You've told the others, well, we'll go and do it. You tell the church, we'll go and do it. And then, is there going to be anyone there? And then we've actually need some money to equip them, and we say this is a great challenge for us as a church, and will any money come? It gets wearing. Pray for your leaders. Pray for your leaders. But you see, as God speaks to Moses. He says, tell the Israelites to move on. Tell the Israelites to move on. Raise your staff. Stretch out your hand over the sea to divide the waters so that the Israelites can go through the sea on dry ground. I'll harden the hearts of the Egyptians so they'll go in after them. And I'll gain glory through Pharaoh and all his army, through his chariots and his horsemen. The Egyptians will know that I am the Lord when I gain glory through Pharaoh, his chariots and his horsemen. I am the Lord is actually all you've got when you tell people to move on. It's actually all you need. I don't know what the chariots are in one or two people's lives. Maybe chariots that mean we've got so far in commitment to Christ, but we're terrified of any further. I need to face them with the I am the Lord. The chariots of terror. They need to be put up alongside the second thing the story tells us, the power of God, and that's verses 21 to 31. See, when you get to the end of the chapter, you'll read, that day, verse 30, the Lord saved Israel. That day, the Lord saved Israel. If you want to put it down to anything or anyone else, you will have missed the point. Verse 21, then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and all that night the Lord drove the sea back with a strong east wind and turned it into dry land. The waters were divided. It gives us a natural explanation for the parting of the Red Sea, the strong east wind. But you divorce that from the supernatural and you separate naively what this writer puts together. One writer put it, without denying the reality of the laws of nature, we must learn to appreciate more deeply that our God is not controlled by his creation. He controls it. All that night the Lord drove the sea back with a strong east wind. And when people hastily pin the label coincidence, it hardly provides an adequate explanation. And it's an amazing way of defending a narrow view of scientific theory that won't allow for the supernatural. The Lord saved Israel, and the Lord destroyed the Egyptians. They plunge in after the Israelites and walk right into the trap. Verse 25, he made the wheels of their chariots come off so that they had difficulty driving. Not quite sure why we need the end of that sentence, but still, there we are. I guess it allows the sun to have affected us heavily this afternoon and still to know what's going on. And the Egyptians said, let's get away from the Israelites. The Lord is fighting for them against Egypt. Finally, it penetrates the immensely thick skulls of the Egyptians. At last, they've got it, but not before they're in it over their heads. The Lord saved Israel, verse 30, from the hand, the power of the Egyptians. Defeated at the very point of their strength, the chariots clogged in the mud. And Israel saw the Egyptians lying dead on the shore. Here's the sign that rescue, freedom, life were assured for Israel. Like baptism, it was a sign of death as well as life. See, there is a need to leave one way of life if we're to enter a new existence, and God has the power to deliver both. For from now on, Egypt will be in the rear view mirror. And the desert wanderings begin. I don't know if you're short of confidence in the Christian life, if you find it hard to imagine that you could ever stand where the Israelites did. But actually, you and I can't be any more feeble than the Israelites were that day. And the forces of evil holding us can't be any more powerful than those chariots. And God's power is no weaker now than then. Verse 31, when the Israelites saw the great power the Lord displayed against the Egyptians, the people feared the Lord. and put their trust in him and in Moses' servant. Well, we don't need to trust in Moses because God's given us another deliverer, a greater than Moses, Jesus. And the forces of evil couldn't have seemed greater than when massed against him on the cross. The deliverer could hardly have seemed weaker, could he? So just keep your finger in Exodus 14 and come on through to Colossians and chapter 2. And read of what God did with the rescuer, not with a staff in his hand, but with his hands on a cross. Verse 12, when you were dead in your sins, and in the uncircumcision of your sinful nature, so there we were, feeble enough, we're dead, God made you alive with Christ. He forgave us all our sins, having cancelled the written code with its regulations that was against us and that stood opposed to us. He took it away, nailing it to the cross. And listen to this. Having disarmed the powers and authorities, he made a public spectacle of them, triumphing over them by the cross. Some of you will know Mark Mennell, who did the Cornhill course once and was my colleague up in Sheffield. He's now teaching in a Bible college in Kampala in Uganda, and he was back with us the other week. And just in a throwaway comment, as someone was asking him a question, he said this. He said, I find that in Uganda, I'm preaching the victory of the cross far more frequently than ever I do back here in the UK. He said, I think it's because out there, the recognition of the powers and forces of evil is so much wider. But I suspect recognition may be wider there. But the need for us to teach the victory of the cross is just as great here. It is the basis for confidence. And it's that victory that the Red Sea is such a graphic picture of. Yeah, the chariots of terror, certainly, but the power of God. So come lastly to the songs of praise, which is chapter 15. Songs of praise come this evening from the Israelite campfires. And it's all in response to the events of the day. Then Moses and the Israelites sang this song to the Lord. It speaks of their experience. It's very personal, and yet it tells me all about God. I will sing to the Lord. It is actually a great lesson for us in our songwriting. How to keep that personal touch, that sense of experience, and yet not have the focus on ourselves, but on our God. I think the greatest of our hymns pull off that combination, don't they? I know some people love to have a go at all the modern songs. They're all terribly subjective and experiential. The old ones are wonderfully objective. If you actually look at them, the classic greats are very personal themselves. And can it be that I should gain? When I survey the wondrous cross? Amazing grace. I once was lost, but now am found. There's plenty of personal experience in the greats. It's just when you finish singing them, you're not full of your own, what it feels like for me, and so on. You're actually full of the God that's evoked those feelings. Actually, there are plenty of moderns that pull it off as well. You know, Jesus is King and I will extol Him. How deep the Father's love for us. It's a compound. We mustn't lose it. We don't want to land up antiseptic in the great gospel truths as we sing them, do we? But happens that they're truths that affect us if we're Christian. And they've affected Moses, they've affected the Israelites. The whole song is rooted in their experience. But there's a tone that's strikingly different and strange here, and we don't often get. Look at verse 3. The Lord is a warrior. If you've got the ESV, the Lord is a man of war. Now, many people don't like the idea of God as a warrior. And if we think of God only as a warrior, then we hardly begin to understand it. And I know when we've only just got out of what for those few weeks was kind of wall-to-wall war on our telescreens, the idea of God as a warrior can seem particularly unhelpful. But to have no idea of God as a warrior, that's not to understand the Christian rescue or the Christian life. So put aside your images of machine guns and tanks, never mind crusades, but understand that this is not an isolated verse. Nearly 300 times, 285 if you want to be precise according to the book I read, God is described as Lord of hosts, Lord of armies. As someone put it, if there is in this world an enemy like Satan, and if sin and evil are hateful to God, then he must wage war against them. My Christian rescue needs that. I can't do it. So does my Christian living. So don't let's domesticate God and leave him so anemic. He doesn't fight for me. He can't prize me from the grip of evil. But actually, what I suspect we find particularly difficult about this song is that God is praised not just for bringing Israel out of Egypt, but for destroying the Egyptian army in the sea. I will sing to the Lord, for he's highly exalted, the horse and the rider, he's hurled into the sea. Well, there again, verse 4, Pharaoh's chariots and his army, he's hurled into the sea. The best of Pharaoh's officers are drowned in the Red Sea. But remember this, will you? Whatever our views about the reasons for starting the war against Iraq, what's actually hard about what's happened, what's hard about the damage done, is not, I suspect, that Saddam is threatened. And Uday and Qusay, when they're killed, I suspect, whatever other outcomes might have been, there is a sense of justice among us. There are evil torturers in that regime. What's hard for us, isn't it, is what seems much more like injustice. Women and children shot in a roadblock. The precision bombs that go astray and hit markets. Friendly fire incidents. You know, that awful phrase, collateral damage, we despise. Oh, those things happen in war, we say. And they do. And it is about time we really got rid of our stupidly unrealistic expectations of what won't happen in a war. Those things do happen in war. It's why it's so ugly and awful. They happen in war, but we don't rejoice in them. And this song's rejoicing. Yes, but notice whose destruction it's rejoicing in. The judgment, for that's what it was, the judgment has come. Well, look, verse 6, on the enemy. Your right hand, O Lord, shattered the enemy. The judgment has come, verse 7, on God's enemy. In the greatness of your majesty, you threw down those who opposed you. The judgment has come on the enemy of God's people, verse 9. The enemy boasted, I will pursue, I will overtake them. I will divide the spoils, I will gorge myself on them. Ah, there's a justice in the destruction of the enemies of God. And you know, if you and I are Christian, one day we're going to cover this song of Moses. We'll bring out a new version. You'll find it if you turn right on to the end of the Bible and to Revelation chapter 15.
As you know, the book of Revelation is full of some very vivid, if not lurid, pictures as it takes us time and again through history. It's a bit like going up a spiral staircase, and you look at history unfolding from a slightly different angle each time as you go round. And we've come to the end of one of these sequences, and God's judgment has been poured out against all of those who have been oppressing and persecuting both God's purposes and God's people. And at the beginning of chapter 15, I saw in heaven another great and marvelous sign, seven angels with the seven last plagues, last because with them God's wrath, God's anger, God's judgments completed. And I saw what looked like a sea of glass mixed with fire, and standing beside the sea, just like those campfires at Exodus 15, those who'd been victorious over the beast and his image and over the number of his name, and they held harps given them by God, and they sang the song of Moses, the servant of God. You know what? The song of Moses is the song of the Lamb, Jesus. Great and marvelous are your deeds, Lord God Almighty. Just and true are your ways, King of the ages. Who will not fear you, O Lord, and bring glory to your name? For you alone are holy. All nations will come and worship before you. For your righteous acts have been revealed. As wicked people who've stood out against God's and God's plans and God's people have been judged. Come to the end of time. Come to the moment when sufferings are fully over and judgment is complete. And like the Israelites by the Red Sea, if you and I are Christian, we'll be giving God credit then. Just as Moses did. See, sometimes people say to us, how are we going to be able to enjoy heaven knowing there's a hell? And the only answer I can imagine is because when I make it to heaven, I will really understand justice as it should be. And I'll be able to rejoice in just things done. There is no salvation without judgment. It was true at the Red Sea. It was true at the cross. It'll be true at the end of time. I must learn to praise God's justice as well as his mercy. They go together. That day, the Lord saved Israel. This is our God. And that Old Testament picture is not greater than reality. So if you're standing terrified on the brink of commitment, go forward. Go forward. He's well able to rescue. And yet what's true of rescue is true throughout the Christian life. Go forward. The God who broke the power of the chariots at the Red Sea is the God who broke the power of the evil one at the cross. What we know and experience now are his death throes. Violently powerful though they can be. And one day they'll be extinguished too. I think that we have a danger of handling victory poorly in our Christian teaching. By the way, all the "we" here is another way of saying I have a danger, but I kind of don't want to sound quite so bad. I think that one of our dangers is this. We respond to a false triumphalism by swinging the pendulum in the kind of classic way back to the other end. And we're so keen to guard everyone against a false triumphalism which just leads to disappointment and despair when you discover the Christian life isn't the easy ride that's expected, that we'll tell everyone all about how hard it is and difficult it is and what knocks you must face. And we sometimes just put a full stop there. I think we can sometimes land up giving an impression almost of a false defeatism, certainly of a false just grit your teethism, as if that's the Christian life.
But you see, the story of the Red Sea is meant to tell me there are all kinds of powers that have been at work in my life, and you may recognize them in one shape or form or another, that were all desperate to keep me out of God's grips. They are, if I'm Christian, in my rear view mirror, and I need to keep them there. I'm just teaching our anonymous middle child, as she sometimes allows me to refer to her in public, how to drive at the moment. And it's wonderful. I just get a running commentary about what she's doing, interspersed with either self-criticism that she's driving badly today, or which quickly will turn to criticism of other drivers who've just made precisely the mistake that she's made and how awful them. She didn't even signal. Didn't even signal. What does he think he did? Why didn't he signal? Sorry, I missed the gear. I'm not driving very well today. Anyway, one of the things she's just got from her driving instructor is the need to use the mirrors. Tell me, Dad, I must look in my mirror. I'm looking in my mirror, she says. I mean, I'm just sitting here, actually. She's actually really rather good, so I'm afraid I just sort of sit back and let her drive. You haven't told me if I'm looking in my mirror. She's got the idea of the rear view mirror. Most of you have been driving so long, you've forgotten the rear view mirror. Because that's what happens, isn't it? Once you pass the test, we just get on with it. Look, the rear view mirror is very important in the Christian life. And understand what should be in it. And leave it there. Those death throes do still seem terribly frightening as we walk on in the Christian life. Well, make sure you've got the headlights on so you see what the future holds. And the future holds the cover album. The day when you and I will be singing the song of Moses. It's the song of Jesus, the song of ultimate triumph. And if I'm going to walk the Christian life, I need to walk with those powers carefully positioned in either in the rear view mirror or in the full thrust of the headlights that will take me to that ultimate victory. And to know those things that are pulling me out of God's way and God's purposes. All those who oppose God, in the end, have only one fate. They're the losers. I must walk knowing that that is where they will land up. That's the victory I can walk in now. See, the identity card of baptism is an identity card to be worn with confidence. He has passed from death to life. If anyone's in Christ, he's a new creation. The old has gone, the new has come. We're going to end by singing a hymn. It's the hymn of someone who knows the triumph of the past and is confident of the triumph of the future. It's number 31, you'll all know it. It's the story of John Newton's Christian testimony. It's actually the story of every Christian's testimony. Amazing Grace, 31.